Should I just start again with the introduction? Okay, so my name is Alil. I'm with the Department of Land Economy, and I'm going to present a little bit of my research that I've been doing over the last 4 years, which is looking at how are women farming in areas that are affected by climate change, particularly around questions of desertification. So if you look at large parts of India and Sri Lanka, parts of Africa where it's already a little bit of on the dry side, when climate does increase over time, these areas get hotter with larger amounts of UV radiation, and the landscape gets a little bit more desertified. So over the last 4 years, my research has really been looking at how are women, particularly women who are operating commercial farms that are sustainable around organic and natural farming practices, operating to continue production amidst this type of very serious climate change. So let's see if I can. My research looked at this particular area in Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka is a little island just off the southern coast of India. And the research looks at 50 farms that are scattered across the northern peninsula of Sri Lanka. All 50 of these farms are operated by women, and they all adopt organic and natural farming practices. It's really interesting to consider this area for a couple of reasons. One is because of the dry nature of this landscape and the lack of water, the rate of desertification is relatively high. Most of Sri Lanka's agriculture also takes place in the dry zone, so in areas like Jaffna, which hosts about 60% of overall production or cultivated lands. Also, Jaffna has 26% of its farms operated by women, so it's more than a quarter of the farms being operated by women, which is another interesting point to consider when you consider women are completely absent from agricultural policy. We'll see in a little bit. This is generally the landscape of agriculture. The landscape in Jaffna, it's quite dry. It's mostly shrubs, if at all. The sand itself has grown to be a little bit more on the beachy side, so it has very little nutrition. It's quite dry. It doesn't have a lot of organic content to hold it together. Crops that grew there years and decades ago now find it a little bit harder to continue production and yield when you have very little nutrition and poor environmental conditions. These conditions are slowly getting more difficult for cultivators because it gets drier, hotter, and the monsoon seasons are changing. Now, this is what a traditional waterway would look like. Because it doesn't have natural rivers and it's farther away from the inland streams and springs that are in the island, most of the water is from underground aquifers, which are embedded underneath the hard rock limestone that exists under the soil. Or you have man-made tanks such as on the left. These are used for religious as well as agricultural and community purposes. And on the right, you have what would look like a shallow pond. These collect rainwater during the monsoon, and then they are used to feed paddy or other crops that a farmer is growing. I'll skip that. And this is what the policy looks like when it comes to women. As you can see, out of the four main agricultural policies, agricultural and climate change policies in Sri Lanka, there are only two references to women. Both of these are very more like a head nod to women than actual concrete understanding of the challenges women go through and the opportunities that exist for them in the agricultural sector. They look at women as people who produce perhaps only on the homestead, such as in terms of referencing home gardening under the National Agriculture Policy. And it's more a question of nutrition. So it centers women amidst the family rather than as commercial economic actors. In the INDC, which is Sri Lanka's commitments to achieving specific aspects of the Paris Agreement, women are clustered quite generally with youth and vulnerable communities. So they're seen in a very passive stance as recipients of developmental assistance or agricultural aid, but not again as economic actors. Both of these references are the only references to women in the agricultural and climate change policies at the time of 2019. if you look at the National Climate Change Policy of Sri Lanka and the readiness plan for INDC, which is how the INDC will be implemented in the country, there are no references to women, which means any references that had been in the INDC would not be transferred into actual policy benefits. Keeping this in mind and considering that 26 or a quarter of farms in Jaffna and 23% of farms across the island are operated by women, you can see that there's a big chunk of farms that will not benefit directly from the types of agricultural support a policy can provide. With that as the context, I'd like to look very quickly at the profile of the women who were surveyed during this study. Of the 50 farms, because there is a lack of targeting towards women, the government was not the primary provider of training. It was actually NGOs or nonprofit organizations that operated in the Northern Peninsula. The government did still train about 75% of the farmers who had been surveyed. The topics that they had been trained on are composting technologies, pest control, fertilizer use, and very general, basic agricultural topics, but very few of them, actually only 7% of the farmers, had received training on climate change or new seed varieties, varieties that would survive in desertified locations. The types of training that the women received was not really aligned or targeting the types of environmental changes the region is seeing. And that was a source of concern when looking at the research data, and considering that in the future, it'll be more and more difficult to use traditional agricultural techniques to continue production in these drastically changed environments. When we see also how women operate off of their farm, once they do the production, how do they sell it? There's very little agency around a woman farmer in a market. And this is because a lot of the agricultural markets in Jaffna are dominated by middle operators. Middle operators serve to function and to serve a function in bridging farmers to larger markets, and particularly for women farmers who do not travel to the marketplace to sell their produce directly to customers. They wind up selling it to middle operators who sell it at conventional agricultural prices, that is, not providing a premium rate for their organic produce or natural produce, or they sell it with additional price markers, such as a 10% waste reduction price that the farmer has to pay, even though the losses are incurred by the middle operator during transportation. In this sense, with these women farmers that were surveyed were reporting that they were receiving well below market prices for the produce that they had produced using very expensive or very time-consuming organic methodologies. The other thing is, because the farmers hadn't really received organic certification for their produce, their produce often gets diluted in the conventional agricultural market and are sold to customers as well at conventional rates. So the underdevelopment of a sustainable organic marketplace in the Jaffna area and the lack of mechanisms to bring women farmers directly into the marketplace, bring that face-to-face contact, or at least better agency or economies of scale and cooperative behavior. These are the types of ways in which the market is underdeveloped and leaves women farmers with less agency and less ability to participate in markets as economic actors. In a way, this means that the farmers are also restricted in the amount of profit that they make from their produce, but also in their independence and agency as economic actors in the Jaffna agriculture sector. This is my favorite part about the study altogether. Going back very quickly to this slide, where you can see the landscape that exists in Jaffna, it's quite dry and arid. And then this is a picture of how these farms look. It's really marvelous to consider that from those dry, arid places, receiving very little training on how to do organic agriculture, the women farmers are able to apply the knowledge that they have about general agriculture to how agricultural ecologies work, or the relationship that is between humans, plants, and animals within a specific environment to create these very lush, productive landscapes. In a way, they are reversing the desertification and the aridification that they see occurring around them to create these very green meadow-like farms on their lands. So very specifically, if you look outside of any of their fences, you'll see shrubbery, you'll see dry beachy sand, and then you see that these farmers create these beautiful microcosms of productive ecologies right on their farms. And what they're doing is they're applying things like canopies, they're applying homemade fertilizers that are organic or produced from waste in their kitchen. They incorporate flowers amidst the crops that they're cultivating. They have like plants that have medicinal value and market value, but at the same time push away certain types of fungus or bugs that might otherwise attack their crops. And they're able to create these very beneficial ecologies to help their production goals while also regenerating their farms that would otherwise be quite unarable. In order to do this, women have been adopting very different, or they've been applying their agricultural techniques that they've learned through their training in different ways. Most of the women are irrigating more often, so they're watering their crops more frequently. They've adjusted their planting and harvesting time as well as the primary crops that they'll grow. Unfortunately, this also means that because of the challenges of environmental changes, some of the farmers, slightly about a quarter of the study group, had started using chemicals to make sure that their production is growing. So this means that some of the farmers are stepping away from organic and sustainable agriculture in order to ensure their harvests are continued. It's also interesting when you consider that many of these farmers have not received any training on climate change and don't conceptually understand that there is a larger trend of environmental degradation because of factors that they cannot control, yet they're still able to map their practices against some of these changes. They accurately understand the impacts of climate change on their crops, which they describe in other parts of the research, and then they adjust their techniques in order to address those specific changes. I want to put this research into consideration for in the context of long-term climate change. If you look at the IPCC's AR6 Working Group 2's report that was published 2 years ago around vulnerability and adaptation, you'll see that the projections for climate change, even at a 1.5 degree world, are still very severe for a lot of the low-lying regions. Many developing countries are based in this belt. And if you look at this one, for example, it shows the degree to which biodiversity will be lost. Some parts of Northern Africa will see over 75% of biodiversity losses at a 1.5 degree Celsius degree of change. And this is very important because 1.5 degrees Celsius is what we're aiming for as a planet. We're aiming to cap climate change at 1.5. But even at that level, if we are losing 75% of our biodiversity, you can imagine the extent to which the reality around some of these communities are changing. Sri Lanka is sitting right here almost invisibly, but they're talking, the map does show it's in the northern parts, it's 50 to 60% of changes in terms of biodiversity in the area that was surveyed. The map up here at the top right shows what portion of the days in a year you would be exposed to extremely dangerous work condition if you were working outside. Being exposed to that level of environmental changes would also mean that you've reduced capacity to work outdoors. This has significant impact on agricultural workers who spend most of their time outdoors. And this type of exposure can be from increased heat, for example, or increased UV radiation. Sri Lanka sits here in the red zone, which is almost every day of the year. Their work capacity would be reduced by up to 40% by mid to late century. The reality is that people who have been born even several decades ago will see some of these changes in their lifetime. It's no longer a next generation question for many developing countries. It's a current generation question. I myself will probably exist in a world that is completely different from what I saw growing up in Jaffna, mostly because even cattle, sheep, cats and dogs that live outdoors would be affected by the degree of climate change that we're expected to see in the next few decades. What I want to contextualize, especially specifically for this research, is women have worked incredibly hard to apply their understanding of agriculture to create these lush, vegetative, productive zones on their farms. Yet, if climate change continues at the pace that we're currently seeing and what we expect to see in the next few decades, it doesn't matter to what degree women or any farmer adapts their agricultural practices, because it would not be possible to farm when your area is so hot and you are exposed to so much radiation that you cannot work outdoors. So this means that at the micro level, adaptation is almost insufficient or inconsequential in the long run. And that points to greater policy level challenges. For example, the UNFCCC currently only finances adaptation and mitigation. Adaptation you can consider as a response to environmental changes that are occurring or have already occurred. And it's financing the ability for people and communities to change their behaviors in a way that allows them to continue to operate and exist in a changed world. Mitigation is trying to stop future changes by perhaps reducing carbon emissions or reducing methane emissions. And what that means is that we're trying to reduce how much more the world will change as a result of future human emissions. There is a gap here because we're not really considering in UNFCCC financing to developing countries. What about changes that have already occurred? What about this future that even if we stop emissions today, will exist for developing countries? Currently, UNFCCC funding and international development funding does not really consider how do we address those changes that have already occurred? How do we repair some of these climate regulating systems that have been deteriorated as a result of climate change and will continue to have impacts in the future? So overall, what my study really I would like to emphasize with this is that there is a lot that we still need to understand about how women are operating, what really drives them and motivates them to continue using organic and natural methods in a world that is becoming more and more difficult to farm in sustainable ways. And then also overall, what is our commitment or what is our responsibility as a global community to ensure that developing countries are not affected by the types of climate change that has already occurred and will continue to have an impact even if we achieve the goals of the Paris Agreement. So that's in a summary what I'd like to speak about today, and thank you so much for listening.
Thank you so much, Halil. It's a very fascinating area, and every time that we discuss this topic, it's a bit depressing, isn't it? Because it faces the reality. But I wanted to ask you a quick question. What's the percentage of women in parliament in Sri Lanka? Because I'm kind of wondering, would that be then the force to drive the changes in terms of legal mechanisms?
Yeah, that's a really great question. Actually, women are very underrepresented in parliament and in the electoral system altogether. I believe there's something like only one or two of the parliamentarians are women. It's something very, very small, and this is out of something like 100 plus parliamentarians. There are quotas for women. However, the electoral system is complicated in that oftentimes names are nominated for sub parliamentary roles, so for example at the district level to have representation, but these are usually governed by party politics. Sometimes it's not a real politician whose name has been put forward. So I would say that the political system does try to make space for women in leadership. However, the way the system is set up, it's still rigged against women. And it's more perfunctory than it is functionary.
Mm-mm-mm. And compared to India, for example, does it have a smaller representation or is the same? I'm not sure. I know the situation in India, but would you say is the same or different?
I don't really have too much data on India. I'm sorry. I don't think I have the best to answer that.
It'd be interesting because so GFS enabled an amazing program a few years ago called Tigress, and in fact Shalaja was one of the people, you know, the academics working on it, and one of the aspects of Tigress was also empowering women in agriculture. So I wonder if perhaps there could be some, you know, some case studies or experience that we could you know, look at and draw some parallelism and apply them to Sri Lanka, if they are applicable, of course.
That would be really interesting, actually. It's also interesting if you consider that India and Sri Lanka have very similar, in the dry zones, very similar climate projections, as well as very similar ecological structures for agricultural areas. So that would certainly be really interesting. And thank you for telling me about that. I'll talk to you next time.
Yes, we can make the connection. Elena has just asked a question, which I'll probably read because I guess you're still in the public place and you can't open your mic. So why do women farmers not attend the markets like men? Are they not allowed?
That's a really great question. I also have that same question when I started my research as well, because Sri Lanka is not particularly conservative in the sense that women are restricted to the home or something, especially in the Jaffna area, which had been through several decades of war. Women have been accustomed to being outdoors and working, being farmers. It's traditional in that sense. However, the way it's set up now is that when you are in a public place, you do feel a little bit more insecure. For example, I think the dynamics in terms of, if you look at how frequently women have been sexually harassed in public spaces in Sri Lanka, public transportation, for example, across the island, I believe it's something like 90%+ of women have experience sexual harassment at some point in public transportation or in public and in public places. So I think that's one level of insecurity. The other thing is that there's also like dynamics, cultural dynamics, where even if a woman was to go to the market, there's still a degree of what's the word that I'm looking for? You sort of social terms are more dictated by men, social interactions. So if you had someone say, this is the fair price for an organic produce, even if it's not, it's less likely women will negotiate if it's a man than it is someone that they see as a peer. So I think there are several reasons that are not fully understood by this research. The purpose of this research was first to understand how women are experiencing the price point in terms of market relations. And then I think it's a good starting place to start understanding why is there this huge negotiation differential between the middle operator and women farmers, and why women farmers are not going to the market themselves as well. A couple of the women did say that they may be more interested in getting participating in a market, or they would get a fairer price if the market was organized by a cooperative, a woman's led cooperative. So there could be some additional research in that area around, does cooperative behavior improve market conditions for women, which other research has shown yes. And then to understand this specifically in Jaffna would be interesting as well. So not a clear answer, just because the research didn't really come to a specific conclusion. But from my general understanding, I would say those would be some factors to consider.
Do you have you worked with the gender studies here in Cambridge at all? Are you happy with this? Because Elaine also has two more questions, but it very quickly, I don't know if you have worked with them, and again, we can make a connection there.
Yeah, sadly, no. My research was, I would say, truncated by COVID. So I only got back last year, and then it was just like writing. And I, because of COVID and being away for 2 years for data collection as well, sort of didn't give me a lot of chance to really network with the right people who could help, you know, improve my research and my understanding in that sense.
Yeah, because it seems like there's a big you know, overlap with gender studies, potentially even sociology. I'm thinking, looking at Abigail, who also works in sociology, and there might be somebody there perhaps who looks at this area. Okay, we'll make the right connections. Ellen, should I read again the questions? Yeah, two more questions. Are the middle operators always men? And is the lack of climate change training specific to women farmers or to farmers in general in that region?
Middle operators are always men. They would have the most mobility in terms of traveling to various markets and connecting farmers to customers. And the lack of climate change training, I would say it's a two-layered problem. One is that the curriculum itself is lacking reference to climate change. Sri Lanka as a whole hasn't adapted its agricultural systems or policies looking forward into the types of climate change that will occur or what has been occurring today. So in that sense, I think the gap in curriculum is something that all farmers are missing out as a result of. However, I think women themselves have less opportunities for training. This sample was well trained, and I think my suspicion is because the primary trainer would be the NGOs. And so as part of developmental packages or livelihood packages delivered by aid agencies, they would train the beneficiaries along the side. And women are often one of the beneficiary groups or preferred priority beneficiary groups when it comes to developmental aid packages. I believe that's where the high degree of training comes from, and also connection for women to training services. Outside of the nonprofit world, though, I would expect that women have even more challenges accessing extension services, which other research has pointed to, and as a result would also have less degree of access to training services. So I think in two ways, or in two layers, women are not experiencing the right training mm-hmm. that they need for the types of climate change we're experiencing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Lynn. Elliot, just a final question. It's kind of grilling you. I just wanted to ask you, if women were more in control of the decision-making process of what to grow and what to, what to put on the market, etc., do you think that there could be also a slight shift towards the more climate change resistant agriculture? I don't know.
It's such a good hypothetical question. If I see the degree to which women have adopted organic farming in the north and the east of Sri Lanka, it's quite a significant portion, but I can't say exactly what that portion is. Furthermore, when I asked in this piece of research, like, why are you doing organic farming? The reasons were often because of the weather and nutrition. Mm-hmm. So I feel like there is an inclination or an attraction of for organic and natural sustainable farming that is somehow beyond pure economics. It's perhaps cultural or like the ecology of how women see themselves in the world. Mm-hmm. I would say yes.
Because mm-hmm. I was also thinking, so before being at the university, I used to work for the CGIAR, and mm-hmm. Obviously the gender was a big part of the research. And I remember that, a lot of the discussions were around the fact that women farmers put their families and children mm-hmm. As almost one of their priorities. And so I'm kind of wondering, with this mindset, also perhaps that informs their choices, which might be also more ecological, and therefore if they have more power, then they might also take decisions that impact in a less damaging way the environment.
For sure, because women perhaps feel more integrated with community, family, environment, and the forms of agriculture that women adopt are less violent in that sense, less about like killing the bugs or less about, you know, really dominating nature for production purposes, which other research has suggested. And I think in this group was also what women were reporting for their own reasons and their own participation in organic farming. I would say that, yeah, like I think the motivations or the rationality with which women engage in agriculture would certainly be a lot more sustainable.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, that's interesting. I mean, in a way, it sounds like that what you've been saying and the discussion goes towards really working on empowering women, trying mm-hmm. to find gender equality, right? And perhaps working, yeah. as you said, given that, of course, it's a bit of a vicious circle. If they don't have representation in parliament, they're not going to change the laws and et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So who can do that for them? And I remember, again, in my days at UN for Women, one way to go is to almost like partner, find male champions who can mm-hmm. support the cause because they can see the benefits. In empowering women. There are not many men, obviously, who do that because they are afraid of losing their own power. But if it's essentially, if you know, if it were possible to show that it's a win-win, then there might be the possibility of having, you know, these champions, then the champions then can promote, you know, mechanisms that put women on the forefront.
I really like that idea because I think it's especially like in the for short-term victories, for example, having a champion is much easier. Mm. I mean, if you think of how long Sri Lanka has been trying to balance the or like give quotas for women leadership in politics, and the while that's that larger political landscape change is occurring, I think in the short run it would be really fantastic if there were people who are really invested in sustainable agriculture, who really see women as a part of the agricultural sector in meaningful ways and not merely as developmental assistance recipients. Okay. It would really change the outcomes for the sector and food security in the country. I think that's a really wonderful idea.
Mm-hmm. So maybe there could be an interesting project that we could maybe even discuss, you know, with say Cambridge Zero, the gender studies, and have a real interdisciplinary approach.
That would be so fantastic.
That would be really interesting. Yeah, let's take this off.
That does remind me of one additional aspect of where artificial intelligence and machine learning has is really interesting to incorporate into our understanding of agricultural systems, because we don't need a lot of farm-to-farm data anymore when you have satellite images and you have ways of mapping out the types of farming and seasonal changes that are occurring by simply looking at satellite photographs through machines through the lens of artificial intelligence, sorry. So in that sense, like I think in terms of also trying to model what 40 years down the line, what types of policy changes we need to bring in to be prepared for the future. These are just like huge questions that we can really start exploring, because now we finally have the capacity to run through such big chunks of data in really coherent ways that human minds couldn't even possibly fathom. So I think that's another really fascinating aspect. If we can like see what these changes will be, what types of policy we need, and how do we bring women into that in like truly meaningful ways for the future, I think that's another fantastic area to look at.
Yeah, and you know, I think also perhaps finding ways of showing the men farmers, in this case in Sri Lanka, that farming in the way that women do can actually be also economically advantageous to them.
Yeah.
Then they might bite into it more easily.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Mm. Really great. It's so exciting thinking about what we can do next, to be honest.
So we've sorted your postdoc program, Elin. Excellent. Thank you so much, Elin. Yeah, we have to sort of take this conversation off record and really have loads of discussions. It'd be great to see where we can take it. Wonderful. Thank you so much. I'm so sorry that there haven't been any more people.
Oh, that's okay. Thank you so much for this opportunity just to share it with you guys. I really enjoyed presenting, you know, and the conversation.